Chapter 12 Fish Eyes. My brother Tony had taken out a loan to buy his own rig, a semi and trailer, but in order to make the payments, he had to keep the truck on the road, so that's where he was living, on the road. Until his wife got sick, and the doctor she had consulted a doctor, put her on bed rest. Tony called Sean and asked if he could run the rig for a week or two. Sean hated trucking long haul, but he said he'd do it if I came along. Dad didn't need me in the junkyard, and Randy could spare me for a few days, so we set off, heading down to Las Vegas, then east to Albuquerque, west to Los Angeles, then up to Washington State. I'd thought I would see the cities, but mostly I saw truck stops and interstate. The windshield was enormous and elevated like a cockpit, which made the cars below seem like toys. The sleeper cab, where the bunks were, was musty and dark as a cave, littered with bags of Doritos and trail mix. Sean drove for days with little sleep, navigating our 50-foot trailer as if it were his own arm. He doctored the books whenever we crossed a checkpoint, to make it seem he was getting more sleep than he was. Every other day we stopped to shower and eat a meal that wasn't dried fruit and granola. Near Albuquerque, the Walmart warehouse was backed up and couldn't unload us for 2 days. We were outside the city. There was nothing but a truck stop and red sand stretching out in all directions, so we ate Cheetos and played Mario Kart in the sleeper. By sunset on the second day, our bodies ached from sitting, and Sean said he should teach me martial arts. We had our first lesson at dusk in the parking lot.
"If you know what you're doing," he said, "you can incapacitate a man with minimal effort. You can control someone's whole body with two fingers. It's about knowing where the weak points are and how to exploit them."
He grabbed my wrist and folded it, bending my fingers downward so they reached uncomfortably toward the inside of my forearm. He continued to add pressure until I twisted slightly, wrapping my arm behind my back to relieve the strain.
"See? This is a weak point," he said. "If I fold it any more, you'll be immobilized."
He grinned his angel grin.
"I won't, though, because it'd hurt like hell."
He let go and said,
"Now you try."
I folded his wrist onto itself and squeezed hard, trying to get his upper body to collapse the way mine had. He didn't move.
"Maybe another strategy for you," he said.
He gripped my wrist a different way. The way an attacker might, he said. He taught me how to break the hold, where the fingers were weakest and the bones in my arm strongest, so that after a few minutes I could cut through even his thick fingers. He taught me how to throw my weight behind a punch and where to aim to crush the windpipe. The next morning, the trailer was unloaded. We climbed into the truck, picked up a new load, and drove for another 2 days, watching the white lines disappear hypnotically beneath the hood, which was the color of bone. We had few forms of entertainment, so we made a game of talking. The game had only two rules. The first was that every statement had to have at least two words in which the first letters were switched.
"You're not my little sister," Sean said. "You're my Siddle Lister."
He pronounced the words lazily, blunting the T's and D's so that it sounded like Siddle Lister. The second rule was that every word that sounded like a number, or like it had a number in it, had to be changed so that the number was one higher. The word two, for example, because it sounds like the number two, would become three.
"Siddle Lister," Sean might say, "we should pay a 11-shin. There's a checkpoint ahead, and I can't a-fived a ticket. Time three, put on your seatbelt."
When we tired of this, we'd turn on the CB and listen to the lonely banter of truckers stretched out across the interstate.
"Look out for a green four-wheeler," a gruff voice said when we were somewhere between Sacramento and Portland. "Been picnicking in my blind spot for a half hour."
A four-wheeler, Sean explained, is what big rigs call cars and pickups. Another voice came over the CB to complain about a red Ferrari that was weaving through traffic at 120 miles per hour.
"Back bastard damn near hit a little blue Chevy, the deep voice bellowed through the static. Shit, there's kids in that Chevy. Anybody up ahead want to cool this hothead down?
The voice gave its location. Sean checked the mile marker. We were ahead.
I'm a white Pete pulling a fridge, he said.
There was silence while everybody checked their mirrors for a Peterbilt with a reefer. Then a third voice, gruffer than the first, answered,
I'm the blue KW, hauling a dry box. I see you,
Sean said, and for my benefit, pointed to a navy-colored Kenworth a few cars ahead. When the Ferrari appeared, multiplied in our many mirrors, Sean shifted into high gear, revving the engine and pulling beside the Kenworth so that the 2 50-foot trailers were running side by side, blocking both lanes. The Ferrari honked, weaved back and forth, braked, honked again.
How long should we keep him back there?
The husky voice said with a deep laugh.
Until he calms down,
Sean answered. 5 miles later, they let him pass. The trip lasted about a week. Then we told Tony to find us a load to Idaho.
Well, Siddle Lister, Sean said when we pulled into the junkyard. Back 3 work.
The Worm Creek Opera House announced a new play, Carousel. Sean drove me to the audition, then surprised me by auditioning himself. Charles was also there, talking to a girl named Sadie, who was 17. She nodded at what Charles was saying, but her eyes were fixed on Sean. At the first rehearsal, she came and sat next to him, laying her hand on his arm, laughing and tossing her hair. She was very pretty, with soft, full lips and large, dark eyes, but when I asked Sean if he liked her, he said he didn't.
She's got fish eyes, he said.
Fish eyes?
Yep, fish eyes. They're dead stupid fish. They're beautiful, but their heads are as empty as a tire.
Sadie started dropping by the junkyard around quitting time, usually with a milkshake for Sean, or cookies or cake. Sean hardly even spoke to her, just grabbed whatever she'd brought him and kept walking toward the corral. She would follow and try to talk to him while he fussed over his horses, until one evening she asked if he would teach her to ride. I tried to explain that our horses weren't broke all the way, but she was determined, so Sean put her on Apollo, and the three of us headed up the mountain. Sean ignored her and Apollo. He offered none of the help he'd given me, teaching me how to stand in the stirrups while going down steep ravines, or how to squeeze my thighs when the horse leapt over a branch. Sadie trembled for the entire ride, but she pretended to be enjoying herself, restoring her lipsticked smile every time he glanced in her direction. At the next rehearsal, Charles asked Sadie about a scene, and Sean saw them talking. Sadie came over a few minutes later, but Sean wouldn't speak to her. He turned his back, and she left crying. What's that about? I said.
Nothing, he said.
By the next rehearsal, a few days later, Sean seemed to have forgotten it. Sadie approached him warily, but he smiled at her, and a few minutes later they were talking and laughing. Sean asked her to cross the street and buy him a Snickers at the dime store. She seemed pleased that he would ask, and hurried out the door. But when she returned a few minutes later and gave him the bar, he said,
What is this shit? I asked for a Milky Way.
You didn't, she said. You said Snickers.
I want a Milky Way.
Sadie left again and fetched the Milky Way. She handed it to him with a nervous laugh, and Sean said,
Where's my Snickers? What, you forgot again?
You didn't want it, she said, her eyes shining like glass. I gave it to Charles.
Go get it.
I'll buy you another.
No,
Sean said, his eyes cold. His baby teeth, which usually gave him an impish, playful appearance, now made him seem unpredictable, volatile.
I want that one. Get it, or don't come back.
A tear slid down Sadie's cheek, smearing her mascara. She paused for a moment to wipe it away and pull up her smile. Then she walked over to Charles and, laughing as if it were nothing, asked if she could have the Snickers. He reached into his pocket and pulled it out, then watched her walk back to Sean. Sadie placed the Snickers in his palm like a peace offering and waited, staring at the carpet. Sean pulled her onto his lap and ate the bar in 3 bites.
"You have lovely eyes," he said. "Just like a fish."
Sadie's parents were divorcing, and the town was awash in rumors about her father. When Mother heard the rumors, she said now it made sense why Sean had taken an interest in Sadie.
"He's always protected angels with broken wings," she said.
Sean found out Sadie's class schedule and memorized it. He made a point of driving to the high school several times a day, particularly at those times when he knew she'd be moving between buildings. He'd pull over on the highway and watch her from a distance, too far for her to come over, but not so far that she wouldn't see him. It was something we did together, he and I, nearly every time we went to town, and sometimes when we didn't need to go to town at all. Until one day, when Sadie appeared on the steps of the high school with Charles. They were laughing together. Sadie hadn't noticed Sean's truck. I watched his face harden, then relax. He smiled at me.
"I have the perfect punishment," he said. "I simply won't see her. All I have to do is not see her, and she will suffer."
He was right. When he didn't return her calls, Sadie became desperate. She told the boys at school not to walk with her for fear Sean would see, and when Sean said he disliked one of her friends, she stopped seeing them. Sadie came to our house every day after school, and I watched the Snickers incident play out over and over in different forms with different objects. Sean would ask for a glass of water. When Sadie brought it, he'd want ice. When she brought that, he'd ask for milk, then water again. Ice, no ice, then juice. This could go on for 30 minutes before, in a final test, he would ask for something we didn't have. Then Sadie would drive to town to buy it. Vanilla ice cream, fries, a burrito, only to have him demand something else the moment she got back. The nights they went out, I was grateful. One night, he came home late and in a strange mood. Everyone was asleep except me, and I was on the sofa reading a chapter of scripture before bed. Sean plopped down next to me.
"Get me a glass of water."
"You break your leg?" I said.
"Get it, or I won't drive you to town tomorrow."
I fetched the water. As I handed it over, I saw the smile on his face, and without thinking, dumped the whole thing on his head. I made it down the hall and was nearly to my room when he caught me.
"Apologize," he said.
Water dripped from his nose onto his t-shirt. "No." He grabbed a fistful of my hair, a large clump, his grip fixed near the root to give him greater leverage, and dragged me into the bathroom. I groped at the door, catching hold of the frame, but he lifted me off the ground, flattened my arms against my body, then dropped my head into the toilet.
"Apologize," he said again.
I said nothing. He stuck my head in further, so my nose scraped the stained porcelain. I closed my eyes, but the smell wouldn't let me forget where I was. I tried to imagine something else, something that would take me out of myself, but the image that came to mind was of Sadie, crouching, compliant. It pumped me full of bile. He held me there, my nose touching the bowl, for perhaps a minute. Then he let me up. The tips of my hair were wet. My scalp was raw. I thought it was over. I'd begun to back away when he seized my wrist and folded it, curling my fingers and palm into a spiral. He continued folding until my body began to coil. Then he added more pressure so that without thinking, without realizing, I twisted myself into a dramatic bow, my back bent, my head nearly touching the floor, my arm behind my back. In the parking lot, when Sean had shown me this hold, I'd moved only a little, responding more to his description than to any physical necessity. It hadn't seemed particularly effective at the time, but now I understood the maneuver for what it was. Control. I could scarcely move, scarcely breathe, without breaking my own wrist. Sean held me in position with one hand, the other he dangled loosely at his side to show me how easy it was. Still harder than if I were Sadie, I thought. As if he could read my mind, he twisted my wrist further. My body was coiled tightly, my face scraping the floor. I'd done all I could to relieve the pressure in my wrist. If he kept twisting, it would break.
"Apologize," he said.
There was a long moment in which fire burned up my arm and into my brain.
"I'm sorry," I said.
He dropped my wrist and I fell to the floor. I could hear his steps moving down the hall. I stood and quietly locked the bathroom door. Then I stared into the mirror at the girl clutching her wrist. Her eyes were glassy and drops slid down her cheeks. I hated her for her weakness, for having a heart to break. That he could hurt her, that anyone could hurt her like that, was inexcusable. "I'm only crying from the pain," I told myself. "From the pain in my wrist, not from anything else." This moment would define my memory of that night, and of the many nights like it, for a decade. In it, I saw myself as unbreakable, as tender as stone. At first, I merely believed this, until one day it became the truth. Then I was able to tell myself, without lying, that it didn't affect me, that he didn't affect me, because nothing affected me. I didn't understand how morbidly right I was, how I had hollowed myself out. For all my obsessing over the consequences of that night, I had misunderstood the vital truth. That it's not affecting me, that was its effect. Chapter 13. Silence in the Churches. In September, the Twin Towers fell. I'd never heard of them until they were gone. Then I watched as planes sank into them, and I stared, bewildered, at the TV as the unimaginably tall structures swayed, then buckled. Dad stood next to me. He'd come in from the junkyard to watch. He said nothing. That evening, he read aloud from the Bible, familiar passages from Isaiah, Luke, and the Book of Revelation, about wars and rumors of wars. 3 days later, when she was 19, Audrey was married, to Benjamin, a blonde-haired farm boy she'd met waitressing in town. The wedding was solemn. Dad had prayed and received a revelation.
"There will be a conflict, a final struggle for the Holy Land," he'd said. "My sons will be sent to war. Some of them will not come home."
I'd been avoiding Sean since the night in the bathroom. He'd apologized. He'd come into my room an hour later, his eyes glassy, his voice croaking, and asked me to forgive him. I'd said that I would, that I already had. But I hadn't. At Audrey's wedding, seeing my brothers in their suits, those black uniforms, my rage turned to fear of some predetermined loss, and I forgave Sean. It was easy to forgive. After all, it was the end of the world. For a month, I lived as if holding my breath. Then there was no draft, no further attacks. The skies didn't darken, the moon didn't turn to blood. There were distant rumblings of war, but life on the mountain remained unchanged. Dad said we should stay vigilant, but by winter, my attention had shifted back to the trifling dramas of my own life. I was 15, and I felt it. Felt the race I was running with time. My body was changing, bloating, swelling, stretching, bulging. I wished it would stop, but it seemed my body was no longer mine. It belonged to itself now, and cared not at all how I felt about these strange alterations, about whether I wanted to stop being a child and become something else. That something else thrilled and frightened me. I'd always known that I would grow differently than my brothers, but I'd never thought about what that might mean. Now it was all I thought about. I began to look for cues to understand this difference, and once I started looking, I found them everywhere. One Sunday afternoon, I helped Mother prepare a roast for dinner. Dad was kicking off his shoes and loosening his tie. He'd been talking since we left the church.
That hemline was 3 inches above Lori's knee, Dad said. What's a woman thinking when she puts on a dress like that?
Mother nodded absently while chopping a carrot. She was used to this particular lecture.
And Jeanette Barney, Dad said. If a woman wears a blouse that low cut, she ought not bend over.
Mother agreed. I pictured the turquoise blouse Jeanette had worn that day. The neckline was only an inch below her collarbone, but it was loose-fitting, and I imagined that if she bent, it would give a full view. As I thought this, I felt anxious, because although a tighter blouse would have made Jeanette's bending more modest, the tightness itself would have been less modest. Righteous women do not wear tight clothing. Other women do that. I was trying to figure out exactly how much tightness would be the right amount when Dad said,
Jeanette waited to bend for that hymnal until I was looking. She wanted me to see.
Mother made a disapproving tisk sound with her teeth, then quartered a potato. This speech would stay with me in a way that 100 of its precursors had not. I would remember the words very often in the years that followed, and the more I considered them, the more I worried that I might be growing into the wrong sort of woman. Sometimes I could scarcely move through a room, I was so preoccupied with not walking or bending or crouching like them. But no one had ever taught me the modest way to bend over, so I knew I was probably doing it the bad way. Sean and I auditioned for a melodrama at Worm Creek. I saw Charles at the first rehearsal and spent half the evening working up the courage to talk to him. When I did, finally, he confided in me that he was in love with Sadie. This wasn't ideal, but it did give us something to talk about. Sean and I drove home together. He sat behind the wheel, glaring at the road as if it had wronged him.
I saw you talking to Charles, he said. You don't want people thinking you're that kind of girl.
The kind that talks?
You know what I mean, he said.
The next night, Sean came into my room unexpectedly and found me smudging my eyelashes with Audrey's old mascara.
You wear makeup now? He said.
I guess. He spun around to leave, but paused in the doorframe.
I thought you were better, he said. But you're just like the rest.
He stopped calling me Siddle Lister.
Let's go, fish eyes, he shouted from across the theater one night.
Charles looked around curiously. Sean began to explain the name, so I started laughing. Loud enough, I hoped, to drown him out. I laughed as if I loved the name. The first time I wore lip gloss, Sean said I was a whore. I was in my bedroom, standing in front of my mirror, trying it out, when Sean appeared in the doorway. He said it like a joke, but I wiped the color from my lips anyway. Later that night, at the theater, when I noticed Charles staring at Sadie, I reapplied it and saw Sean's expression twist. The drive home that night was tense. The temperature outside had fallen well below zero. I said I was cold, and Sean moved to turn up the heat. Then he paused, laughed to himself, and rolled all the windows down. The January wind hit me like a bucket of ice. I tried to roll up my window, but he'd put on the child lock. I asked him to roll it up. I'm cold, I kept saying. I'm really, really cold. He just laughed. He drove all 12 miles like that, cackling as if it were a game, as if we were both in on it, as if my teeth weren't clattering. I thought things would get better when Sean dumped Sadie. I suppose I'd convinced myself that it was her fault, the things he did, and that without her, he would be different. After Sadie, he took up with an old girlfriend, Erin. She was older, less willing to play his games, and at first it seemed I was right, that he was doing better. Then Charles asked Sadie to dinner. Sadie said yes, and Sean heard about it. I was working late at Randy's that night when Sean turned up, frothing at the mouth. I left with him, thinking I could calm him, but I couldn't. He drove around town for 2 hours searching for Charles's Jeep, cursing and swearing that when he found that bastard, he was gonna give him a new face. I sat in the passenger seat of his truck, listening to the engine rev as it guzzled diesel, watching the yellow lines disappear beneath the hood. I thought of my brother as he had been, as I remembered him, as I wanted to remember him. I thought of Albuquerque and Los Angeles, and of the miles of lost interstate in between. A pistol lay on the seat between us, and when he wasn't shifting gears, Sean picked it up and caressed it, sometimes spinning it over his index like a gunslinger before laying it back on the seat, where light from passing cars glinted off the steel barrel. I awoke with needles in my brain, thousands of them, biting, blocking out everything. Then they disappeared for one dizzying moment, and I got my bearings. It was morning, early. Amber sunlight poured in through my bedroom window. I was standing, but not on my own strength. Two hands were gripping my throat, and they'd been shaking me. The needles, that was my brain crashing into my skull. I had only a few seconds to wonder why before the needles returned, shredding my thoughts. My eyes were open, but I saw only white flashes. A few sounds made it through to me.
Slut! Whore!
Then another sound. Mother. She was crying.
Stop! You're killing her! Stop!
She must have grabbed him, because I felt his body twist. I fell to the floor. When I opened my eyes, Mother and Sean were facing each other, Mother wearing only a tattered bathrobe. I was yanked to my feet. Sean grasped a fistful of my hair, using the same method as before, catching the clump near my scalp so he could maneuver me, and dragged me into the hallway. My head was pressed into his chest. All I could see were bits of carpet flying past my tripping feet. My head pounded. I had trouble breathing, but I was starting to understand what was happening. Then there were tears in my eyes. From the pain, I thought.
Now the bitch cries, Sean said. Why? Because someone sees you for the slut you are?
I tried to look at him, to search his face for my brother, but he shoved my head toward the ground and I fell. I scrambled away, then pulled myself upright. The kitchen was spinning. Strange flecks of pink and yellow drifted before my eyes. Mother was sobbing, clawing at her hair.
I see you for what you are, Sean said.
His eyes were wild.
You pretend to be saintly and churchish, but I see you. I see how you prance around with Charles like a prostitute.
He turned to Mother to observe the effect of his words on her. She had collapsed at the kitchen table.
She does not, Mother whispered.
Sean was still turned toward her. He said she had no idea of the lies I told, how I'd fooled her, how I played the good girl at home, but in town I was a lying whore. I inched toward the back door. Mother told me to take her car and go. Sean turned to me.
You'll be needing these, he said,
holding up Mother's keys.
She's not going anywhere until she admits she's a whore, Sean said.
He grabbed my wrist, and my body slipped into the familiar posture, head thrust forward, arm coiled around my lower back, wrist folded absurdly onto itself. Like a dance step, my muscles remembered and raced to get ahead of the music. The air poured from my lungs as I tried to bend deeper to give my wrist bone every possible inch of relief.
Say it,
he said. But I was somewhere else. I was in the future. In a few hours, Sean would be kneeling by my bed, and he'd be so very sorry. I knew it even as I hunched there.
What's going on?
A man's voice floated up from the stairwell in the hall. I turned my head and saw a face hovering between two wooden railings. It was Tyler. I was hallucinating. Tyler never came home. As I thought that, I laughed out loud, a high-pitched cackle. What kind of lunatic would come back here once he'd escaped? There were now so many pink and yellow specks in my vision, it was as if I were inside a snow globe. That was good. It meant I was close to passing out. I was looking forward to it. Sean dropped my wrist, and again I fell. I looked up and saw that his gaze was fixed on the stairwell. Only then did it occur to me that Tyler was real. Sean took a step back. He had waited until Dad and Luke were out of the house, away on a job, so his physicality could go unchallenged. Confronting his younger brother, less vicious but powerful in his own way, was more than he'd bargained for.
"What's going on?" Tyler repeated.
He eyed Sean, inching forward as if approaching a rattlesnake. Mother stopped crying. She was embarrassed. Tyler was an outsider now. He'd been gone for so long, he'd been shifted to that category of people who we kept secrets from. Who we kept this from. Tyler moved up the stairs, advancing on his brother. His face was taut, his breath shallow, but his expression held no hint of surprise. It seemed to me that Tyler knew exactly what he was doing, that he had done this before when they were younger and less evenly matched. Tyler halted his forward march, but he didn't blink. He glared at Sean as if to say, "Whatever is happening here, it's done." Sean began to murmur about my clothes and what I did in town. Tyler cut him off with a wave of his hand. "I don't want to know," he said. Then, turning to me, "Go, get out of here."
"She's not going anywhere," Sean repeated, flashing the key ring.
Tyler tossed me his own keys.
"Just go," he said.
I ran to Tyler's car, which was wedged between Sean's truck and the chicken coop. I tried to back out, but I stomped too hard on the gas and the tires spun out, sending gravel flying. On my second attempt, I succeeded. The car shot backward and circled around. I shifted into drive and was ready to shoot down the hill when Tyler appeared on the porch. I lowered the window.
"Don't go to work," he said. "He'll find you there."
That night, when I came home, Sean was gone. Mother was in the kitchen blending oils. She said nothing about that morning, and I knew I shouldn't mention it. I went to bed, but I was still awake hours later when I heard a pickup roar up the hill. A few minutes later, my bedroom door creaked open. I heard the click of the lamp, saw the light leaping over the walls, and felt his weight drop onto my bed. I turned over and faced him. He'd put a black velvet box next to me. When I didn't touch it, he opened the box and withdrew a string of milky pearls. He said he could see the path I was going down, and it was not good. I was losing myself, becoming like other girls, frivolous, manipulative, using how I looked to get things. I thought about my body, all the ways it had changed. I hardly knew what I felt toward it. Sometimes I did want it to be noticed, to be admired, but then afterward I'd think of Jeanette Barney and I'd feel disgusted.
"You're special, Tara," Sean said.
Was I? I wanted to believe I was. Tyler had said I was special once, years before. He'd read me a passage of scripture from the Book of Mormon about a sober child, quick to observe. "This reminds me of you," Tyler had said. The passage described the great prophet Mormon, a fact I'd found confusing. A woman could never be a prophet, yet here was Tyler telling me I reminded him of one of the greatest prophets of all. I still don't know what he meant by it, but what I understood at the time was that I could trust myself, that there was something in me, something like what was in the prophets, and that it was not male or female, not old or young, a kind of worth that was inherent and unshakable. But now, as I gazed at the shadow Sean cast on my wall, aware of my maturing body, of its evils, and of my desire to do evil with it, the meaning of that memory shifted. Suddenly, that worth felt conditional, like it could be taken or squandered. It was not inherent. It was bestowed. What was of worth was not me, but the veneer of constraints and observances that obscured me. I looked at my brother. He seemed old in that moment, wise. He knew about the world. He knew about worldly women. So I asked him to keep me from becoming one.
"Okay, Fish Eyes," he said. "I will."
When I awoke the next morning, My neck was bruised and my wrist swollen. I had a headache. Not an ache in my brain, but an actual aching of my brain, as if the organ itself was tender. I went to work, but came home early and lay in a dark corner of the basement, waiting it out. I was lying on the carpet, feeling the pounding in my brain, when Tyler found me and folded himself onto the sofa near my head. I was not pleased to see him. The only thing worse than being dragged through the house by my hair was Tyler's having seen it. Given the choice between letting it play out and having Tyler there to stop it, I'd have chosen to let it play out. Obviously, I would have chosen that. I'd been close to passing out anyway, and then I could have forgotten about it. In a day or two, it wouldn't have even been real. It would become a bad dream, and in a month, a mere echo of a bad dream. But Tyler had seen it, had made it real.
"Have you thought about leaving?" Tyler asked.
"And go where?"
"School," he said.
I brightened. "I'm going to enroll in high school in September," I said. "Dad won't like it, but I'm gonna go." I thought Tyler would be pleased. Instead, he grimaced.
"You've said that before."
"I'm going to."
"Maybe," Tyler said. "But as long as you live under Dad's roof, it's hard to go when he asks you not to. Easy to delay just one more year until there aren't any years left. If you start as a sophomore, can you even graduate?"
We both knew I couldn't.
"It's time to go, Tara," Tyler said. "The longer you stay, the less likely you will ever leave."
"You think I need to leave?" Tyler didn't blink, didn't hesitate.
"I think this is the worst possible place for you."
He'd spoken softly, but it felt as though he'd shouted the words. "Where could I go?"
"Go where I went," Tyler said. "Go to college."
I snorted.
"BYU takes homeschoolers," he said.
"Is that what we are?" I said. "Homeschoolers?" I tried to remember the last time I'd read a textbook.
"The admissions board won't know anything except what we tell them," Tyler said. "If we say you were homeschooled, they'll believe it."
"I won't get in."
"You will," he said. "Just pass the ACT. One lousy test."
Tyler stood to go.
"There's a world out there, Tara," he said. "And it will look a lot different once Dad is no longer whispering his view of it in your ear."
The next day, I drove to the hardware store in town and bought a slide bolt lock for my bedroom door. I dropped it on my bed, then fetched a drill from the shop and started fitting screws. I thought Sean was out, his truck wasn't in the driveway, but when I turned around with the drill, he was standing in my doorframe.
"What are you doing?" he said.
"Doorknob's broke," I lied. "Door blows open. This lock was cheap, but it'll do the trick." Sean fingered the thick steel, which I was sure he could tell was not cheap at all. I stood silently, paralyzed by dread, but also by pity. In that moment, I hated him, and I wanted to scream it in his face. I imagined the way he would crumple, crushed under the weight of my words and his own self-loathing. Even then, I understood the truth of it, that Sean hated himself far more than I ever could.
"You're using the wrong screws," he said. "You need long ones for the wall and grabbers for the door. Otherwise, it'll bust right off."
We walked to the shop. Sean shuffled around for a few minutes, then emerged with a handful of steel screws. We walked back to the house, and he installed the lock, humming to himself and smiling, flashing his baby teeth. Chapter 14. My feet no longer touch earth. In October, Dad won a contract to build industrial granaries in Malad City, the dusty farm town on the other side of Buck's Peak. It was a big job for a small outfit. The crew was just Dad, Sean, Luke, and Audrey's husband, Benjamin. But Sean was a good foreman, and with him in charge, Dad had acquired a reputation for fast, reliable work. Sean wouldn't let Dad take shortcuts. Half the time I passed the shop, I'd hear the two of them shouting at each other. Dad saying Sean was wasting time, Sean screaming that Dad had damned near taken someone's head off. Sean worked long days cleaning, cutting, and welding the raw materials for the granaries, and once construction began, he was usually on site in Malad. When he and Dad came home, hours after sunset, they were nearly always cussing. Sean wanted to professionalize the operation, to invest the profits from the Malad job in new equipment. Dad wanted things to stay the same. Sean said Dad didn't understand that construction was more competitive than scrapping, and that if they wanted to land real contracts, they needed to spend real money on real equipment. Specifically, a new welder and a man lift with a basket.
"We can't keep using a forklift and an old cheese pallet," Sean said. "It looks like shit, and it's dangerous besides."
Dad laughed out loud at the idea of a man basket. He'd been using a forklift and pallet for 20 years. I worked late most nights. Randy planned to take a big road trip to find new accounts, and he'd asked me to manage the business while he was gone. He taught me how to use his computer to keep the books, process orders, maintain inventory. It was from Randy that I first heard of the internet. He showed me how to get online, how to visit a web page, how to write an email. The day he left, he gave me a cell phone so he could reach me at all hours. Tyler called one night just as I was getting home from work. He asked if I was studying for the ACT. "I can't take the test," I said. "I don't know any math."
"You've got money," Tyler said. "Buy books and learn it."
I said nothing. College was irrelevant to me. I knew how my life would play out. When I was 18 or 19, I would get married. Dad would give me a corner of the farm, and my husband would put a house on it. Mother would teach me about herbs, and also about midwifery, which she'd gone back to now the migraines were less frequent. When I had children, Mother would deliver them, and one day, I supposed, I would be the midwife. I didn't see where college fit in. Tyler seemed to read my thoughts.
"You know Sister Sears?" he said.
Sister Sears was the church choir director.
"How do you think she knows how to lead a choir?"
I'd always admired Sister Sears and been jealous of her knowledge of music. I'd never thought about how she'd learned it.
"She studied," Tyler said. "Did you know you can get a degree in music? If you had one, you could give lessons. You could direct the church choir. Even Dad won't argue with that. Not much, anyway."
Mother had recently purchased a trial version of AOL. I'd only ever used the internet at Randy's, for work, but after Tyler hung up, I turned on our computer and waited for the modem to dial. Tyler had said something about BYU's webpage. It took only a few minutes to find it. Then the screen was full of pictures. Of neat brick buildings the color of sunstone, surrounded by emerald trees, of beautiful people walking and laughing, with books tucked under their arms and backpacks slung over their shoulders. It looked like something from a movie. A happy movie. The next day, I drove 40 miles to the nearest bookstore and bought a glossy ACT study guide. I sat on my bed and turned to the mathematics practice test. I scanned the first page. It wasn't that I didn't know how to solve the equations. I didn't recognize the symbols. It was the same on the second page, and the third. I took the test to Mother. "What's this?" I asked.
"Math," she said.
"Then where are the numbers?"
"It's algebra. The letters stand in for numbers."
"How do I do it?" Mother fiddled with a pen and paper for several minutes, but she wasn't able to solve any of the first five equations. The next day, I drove the same 40 miles, 80 round trip, and returned home with a large algebra textbook. Every evening, as the crew was leaving Malad, Dad would phone the house so Mother could have dinner waiting when the truck bumped up the hill. I listened for that call, and when it came, I would get in Mother's car and drive away. I didn't know why. I would go to Worm Creek, where I'd sit in the balcony and watch rehearsals, my feet on the ledge, a math book open in front of me. I hadn't studied math since long division, and the concepts were unfamiliar. I understood the theory of fractions, but struggled to manipulate them, and seeing a decimal on a page made my heart race. Every night for a month, I sat in the opera house in a chair of red velvet and practiced the most basic operations, how to multiply fractions, how to use a reciprocal, how to add and multiply and divide with decimals, while on the stage, characters recited their lines. I began to study trigonometry. There was solace in its strange formulas and equations. I was drawn to the Pythagorean theorem and its promise of a universal, the ability to predict the nature of any three points containing a right angle anywhere, always. What I knew of physics I had learned in the junkyard, where the physical world often seemed unstable, capricious. But here was a principle through which the dimensions of life could be defined, captured. Perhaps reality was not wholly volatile. Perhaps it could be explained, predicted. Perhaps it could be made to make sense. The misery began when I moved beyond the Pythagorean theorem to sine, cosine, and tangent. I couldn't grasp such abstractions. I could feel the logic in them, could sense their power to bestow order and symmetry, but I couldn't unlock it. They kept their secrets, becoming a kind of gateway beyond which I believed there was a world of law and reason. But I could not pass through the gate. Mother said that if I wanted to learn trigonometry, it was her responsibility to teach me. She set aside an evening, and the two of us sat at the kitchen table, scratching at bits of paper and tugging our hair. We spent 3 hours on a single problem, and every answer we produced was wrong.
"I wasn't any good at trig in high school," Mother moaned, slamming the book shut. "And I've forgotten what little I knew."
Dad was in the living room, shuffling through blueprints for the granaries and mumbling to himself. I'd watched him sketch those blueprints, watched him perform the calculations, altering this angle or lengthening that beam. Dad had little formal education in mathematics, but it was impossible to doubt his aptitude. Somehow I knew that if I put the equation before my father, he would be able to solve it. When I'd told Dad that I planned to go to college, he'd said a woman's place was in the home, that I should be learning about herbs. God's pharmacy, he'd called it, smiling to himself, so I could take over for Mother. He'd said a lot more, of course, about how I was whoring after man's knowledge instead of God's, but still I decided to ask him about trigonometry. Here was a sliver of man's knowledge I was certain he possessed. I scribbled the problem on a fresh sheet of paper. Dad didn't look up as I approached, so gently, slowly, I slid the paper over the blueprints.
"Dad, can you solve this?"
He looked at me harshly, then his eyes softened. He rotated the paper, gazed at it for a moment, and began to scrawl, numbers and circles and great arcing lines that doubled back on themselves. His solution didn't look like anything in my textbook. It didn't look like anything I had ever seen. His mustache twitched. He mumbled. Then he stopped scribbling, looked up, and gave the correct answer. I asked how he'd solved it.
"I don't know how to solve it," he said, handing me the paper. "All I know is that's the answer."
I walked back to the kitchen, comparing the clean, balanced equation to the mayhem of unfinished computations and dizzying sketches. I was struck by the strangeness of that page. Dad could command this science, could decipher its language, decrypt its logic, could bend and twist and squeeze from it the truth. But as it passed through him, it turned to chaos. I studied trigonometry for a month. I sometimes dreamed about sine, cosine, and tangent, about mysterious angles and concussed computations. But for all this, I made no real progress. I could not self-teach trigonometry. But I knew someone who had. Tyler told me to meet him at our Aunt Debbie's house, because she lived near Brigham Young University. The drive was 3 hours. I felt uncomfortable knocking on my aunt's door. She was Mother's sister, and Tyler had lived with her during his first year at BYU, but that was all I knew of her. Tyler answered the door. We settled in the living room while Debbie prepared a casserole. Tyler solved the equations easily, writing out orderly explanations for every step. He was studying mechanical engineering, set to graduate near the top of his class, and soon after would start a PhD at Purdue. My trig equations were far beneath his abilities, but if he was bored, he didn't show it. He just explained the principles patiently, over and over. The gate opened a little, and I peeked through it. Tyler had gone, and Debbie was pushing a plate of casserole into my hands when the phone rang. It was Mother.
"There's been an accident in Malad," she said.
Mother had little information. Sean had fallen. He'd landed on his head. Someone had called 911, and he'd been airlifted to a hospital in Pocatello. The doctors weren't sure if he would live. That was all she knew. I wanted more, some statement of the odds, even if it was just so I could reason against them. I wanted her to say, "They think he'll be fine," or even, "They expect we'll lose him." Anything but what she was saying, which was, "They don't know." Mother said I should come to the hospital. I imagined Sean on a white gurney, the life leaking out of him. I felt such a wave of loss that my knees nearly buckled. But in the next moment, I felt something else. Relief. There was a storm coming, set to lay 3 feet of snow over Sardine Canyon, which guarded the entrance to our valley. Mother's car, which I had driven to Debbie's, had bald tires. I told Mother I couldn't get through. The story of how Sean fell would come to me in bits and pieces, thin lines of narrative from Luke and Benjamin, who were there. It was a frigid afternoon, and the wind was fierce, whipping the fine dust up in soft clouds. Sean was standing on a wooden pallet, 20 feet in the air. 12 feet below him was a half-finished concrete wall, with rebar jutting outward like blunt skewers. I don't know for certain what Sean was doing on the pallet, but he was probably fitting posts or welding, because that was the kind of work he did. Dad was driving the forklift. I've heard conflicting accounts of why Sean fell. My account of Sean's fall is based on the story as it was told to me at the time. Tyler was told the same story, in fact. Many of the details in this account come from his memory. Asked 15 years later, others remember it differently. Mother says Sean was not standing on a pallet, only on forklift tines. Luke remembers the pallet, but substitutes a metal drain, with the grating removed, in place of the rebar. He says the fall was 12 feet, and that Sean began acting strangely as soon as he regained consciousness. Luke has no memory of who dialed 911, but says there were men working in a nearby mill, and he suspects that one of them called immediately after Sean fell. Someone said Dad moved the boom unexpectedly, and Sean pitched over the edge. But the general consensus is that Sean was standing near the brink and for no reason at all stepped backward and lost his footing. He plunged 12 feet, his body revolving slowly in the air so that when he struck the concrete wall with its outcropping of rebar, he hit head first, then tumbled the last 8 feet to the dirt. This is how the fall was described to me, but my mind sketches it differently. On a white page with evenly spaced lines. He ascends, falls at a slope, strikes the rebar, and returns to the ground. I perceive a triangle. The event makes sense when I think of it in these terms. Then the logic of the page yields to my father. Dad looked Sean over. Sean was disoriented. One of his pupils was dilated and the other wasn't, but no one knew what that meant. No one knew that it meant there was a bleed inside his brain. Dad told Sean to take a break. Luke and Benjamin helped him prop himself against the pickup, then went back to work. The facts after this point are even more hazy. The story I heard was that 15 minutes later, Sean wandered onto the site. Dad thought he was ready to work and told him to climb onto the pallet, and Sean, who never liked being told what to do, started screaming at Dad about everything. The equipment, the granary designs, his pay. He screamed himself hoarse. Then, just when Dad thought he had calmed down, he gripped Dad around the waist and flung him like a sack of grain. Before Dad could scramble to his feet, Sean took off, leaping and howling and laughing, and Luke and Benjamin, now sure something was very wrong, chased after him. Luke reached him first, but couldn't hold him. Then Benjamin added his weight, and Sean slowed a little. But it wasn't until all three men tackled him, throwing his body to the ground, where, because he was resisting, his head hit hard, that he finally lay still. No one has ever described to me what happened when Sean's head struck that second time. Whether he had a seizure, or vomited, or lost consciousness, I'm not sure. But it was so chilling that someone, maybe Dad, probably Benjamin, dialed 911, which no member of my family had ever done before. They were told a helicopter would arrive in minutes. Later, the doctor would speculate that when Dad, Luke, and Benjamin had wrestled Sean to the ground and he'd sustained a concussion, he was already in critical condition. They said it was a miracle he hadn't died the moment his head hit the ground. I struggle to imagine the scene while they waited for the chopper. Dad said that when the paramedics arrived, Sean was sobbing, begging for mother. By the time he reached the hospital, his state of mind had shifted. He stood naked on the gurney, eyes bulging, bloodshot, screaming that he would rip out the eyes of the next bastard who came near him. Then he collapsed into sobs and finally lost consciousness. Sean lived through the night. In the morning, I drove to Buck's Peak. I couldn't explain why I wasn't rushing to my brother's bedside. I told Mother I had to work. "He's asking for you," she said. "You said he doesn't recognize anyone." "He doesn't," she said. "But the nurse just asked me if he knows someone named Tara. He said your name over and over this morning, when he was asleep and when he was awake. I told them Tara is his sister, and now they're saying it would be good if you came. He might recognize you, and that would be something. Yours is the only name he said since he got to the hospital." I was silent. "I'll pay for the gas," Mother said. She thought I wouldn't come because of the $30 it would cost in fuel. I was embarrassed that she thought that, but then, if it wasn't the money, I had no reason at all. "I'm leaving now," I said. I remember strangely little of the hospital, or of how my brother looked. I vaguely recall that his head was wrapped in gauze, and that when I asked why, Mother said the doctors had performed a surgery, cutting into his skull to relieve some pressure, or stop a bleed, or repair something. Actually, I can't remember what she said. Sean was tossing and turning like a child with a fever. I sat with him for an hour. A few times his eyes opened, but if he was conscious, he didn't recognize me. When I came the next day, he was awake. I walked into the room, and he blinked and looked at Mother, as if to check that she was seeing me too.
"You came," he said.
"I didn't think you would."
He took my hand and then fell asleep. I stared at his face, at the bandages wrapped around his forehead and over his ears, and was bled of my bitterness. Then I understood why I hadn't come sooner. I'd been afraid of how I would feel, afraid that if he died, I might be glad. I'm sure the doctors wanted to keep him in the hospital, but we didn't have insurance, and the bill was already so large that Sean would be making payments a decade later. The moment he was stable enough to travel, we took him home. He lived on the sofa in the front room for 2 months. He was physically weak. It was all he had in him to make it to the bathroom and back. He'd lost his hearing completely in one ear and had trouble hearing with the other, so he often turned his head when people spoke to him, orienting his better ear toward them rather than his eyes. Except for this strange movement and the bandages from the surgery, he looked normal. No swelling, no bruises. According to the doctors, this was because the damage was very serious. A lack of external injuries meant the damage was all internal. It took some time for me to realize that although Sean looked the same, he wasn't. He seemed lucid, but if you listened carefully, his stories didn't make sense. They weren't really stories at all, just one tangent after another. I felt guilty that I hadn't visited him immediately in the hospital, so to make it up to him, I quit my job and tended him day and night. When he wanted water, I fetched it. If he was hungry, I cooked. Sadie started coming around, and Sean welcomed her. I looked forward to her visits because they gave me time to study. Mother thought it was important that I stay with Sean so no one interrupted me. For the first time in my life, I had long stretches in which to learn without having to scrap or strain tinctures or check inventory for Randy. I examined Tyler's notes.